This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
This is a lecture that is a particular passion of mine. I love stories. I've been writing little stories ever since I was a kid. I know a lot of you love stories too, and I've been thinking of that this term just as a number of conversations about stories have popped up, and I know a good number of you turned out for a Flannery O'Connor story on Thursday night at Phillips Place, so I figured you guys would be interested, and Flannery O'Connor was a big impetus for this lecture, and a lot of the ideas that I'll be talking about come from a book that collects her essays and lectures called Mystery and Manners. Which my copy is being lent out right now, but I just saw another copy on the table in the library. So if you're interested afterwards, you could explore that more here. So who was Flannery O'Connor? She was an American author. She lived in the American South, wrote great stories and a couple of novels in the 1940s and 1950s. And just for those of you who aren't familiar with her work, to kind of give you a sense of the kind of stories that she wrote, you have the story that you heard on Thursday night, or those of you who went, about a woman who meets a Bible salesman, tries to seduce him, and then he steals her wooden leg and runs away with it. In another story, there's a kind of sociopath prison escapee who murders an entire family when they're on vacation. In another of her stories, a juvenile delinquent convinces a little boy to commit suicide in order to be reunited with his mother. What else? There's a tramp who comes to a house, and the mother convinces him to marry her daughter, I think pays him, actually, and then he abandons her at a rest stop and runs away. So not the happiest stories in the world. They can be a bit strange. And there was this wonderful thing that Flannery O'Connor relayed in one of these essays in Mystery and Manners, where she's talking about a letter that she received once from a reader, an elderly woman in California, who wrote Flannery a letter saying, you know, at the end of the day, all a tired person wants is to come to a story that will lift up their heart. And Flannery O'Connor said, I took that to mean that her heart had not been lifted up by anything that I had written. And then she says this really interesting thing, which was the impetus of this lecture for me. She says, not, oh, well, you know, she has her taste and I have mine. And she didn't say, who are you to think that your heart should be uplifted? That's not important. You know, get into the grit of the world and, you know, leave your sentimentality behind. She doesn't say either of those things. She says, I think that if her heart had been in the right place, it would have been uplifted. So if her heart had been in the right place, I think it would have been uplifted by the story about this boy committing suicide, or the woman who gets her leg stolen, or the woman who gets abandoned at a rest stop, or the sociopath that kills a whole family. So that was Flannery O'Connor's stance. So I read that and just thought, how in the world is that possible? Like, what does that even mean? How can our hearts be uplifted by stories like that? And her stories aren't the only ones that I'm thinking of. I mean, I think we live in an era right now where there's darkness in the stories all around us. And when I'm talking about stories, I'm not talking about one particular medium. I'm talking about any kind of narrative. So novels and short stories, plays, podcast dramas, television shows, poetry, oral stories. So often these stories don't end in a way that feels satisfying. And so often they feature an anti-hero, which is a hero who lacks heroic qualities, or a villain who's actually very winsome and you feel very drawn to and you fall in love with. And over the years and many conversations with people about stories, I think I can say with confidence that that can be hard for a lot of us. And we don't exactly know what to do with that. I think we instinctively recognize how important stories are and how powerful they are. I mean, stories kind of take events and symbols and they draw them together in a cohesive narrative that says something transcendent about the world. And we've all had the experience of entering into a story and finding that it has the power to move us emotionally in a deep way or to change our minds about something. I think many of us have had an experience like that where we've read a story or watched a film and have completely changed our thinking about a particular topic or issue, have even changed the course of our lives. So rightfully, we're concerned about those stories. Seeing how powerful they are, we wonder, what does it look like to engage with them well? I think all of us, you know, whether we're Christians or non-Christians, young or old, have this concern. And then I think for those of us who are followers of Jesus, there are some extra things that get thrown into the mix, like what kind of a story is pleasing to God? Like, what is a Christian story? What do I do with sin when I see it in stories? How do I interact with a story that is twisted or about twisted people? Will it twist me? Will it warp me? Will it make me less like Christ somehow? So I think these are all really good questions. And although there are stories out there that deeply disturb us or anger us or sadden us, I want to argue tonight for deeply engaging with those stories. And I think hopefully over the course of this evening we'll find that it is possible to have our hearts uplifted by something that's even dark and disturbing. So we'll see. We can talk about it. So as far as I can tell, there are sort of two approaches for engaging with fiction. And again, I'm talking about all kind of narratives. So we have what I'm calling the exclude viewpoint. And just probably the best examples for these approaches come from the world of film, simply because it's a very powerful medium. It's highly visual. So film gets a lot of interaction culturally when people are having this discussion, perhaps more than you would find in a play or a novel or something like that. So there's a few websites out there, and probably you guys are familiar with more, that rate films according not only to their kind of quality as a film and as it meets its purposes or as, you know, the quality of its acting or cinematography, but also along kind of moral lines. So there's like movieguide.org. There's another one called christiananswers.net. And these tend to review all the latest blockbusters, and they have an eye to both, you know, how the film is made and what it's like. And movieguide.org, in addition, has kind of a worldview perspective and has like a glossary of terms, which I think is really helpful, like defining humanism and then helping you see where it appears in films or romanticism or something like that. And then that secondary metric is called like a morality rating or an acceptability rating. And pretty much universally across these websites, they rate the presence of language, sex, or nudity, language, nudity, violence, and, yeah, sex. So those would be the four that are probably discussed and rated. So on the one hand, you know, I think these websites are doing, they're performing an important function in our culture in the sense that they're looking at these films, they're trying to understand what's in them, and then they're also, you know, especially as people are thinking about watching the film in mixed company, they help them identify certain markers of things that might be distasteful to some of those people. But I do think you encounter some issues with this kind of evaluative technique, the second one that rates the presence of certain visual markers of sex or nudity or language or something. So I looked up a couple of films that we've shown here before and that I quite like. So there's one film called Calvary, which came out in 2014. Has anyone seen Calvary? So it's an Irish film about a priest, and Calvary being the title, you can imagine the themes that are being played with here. But he's a priest who is told, and I'm not spoiling anything because it happens in the first 30 seconds of the film, he's told that he's going to die, that a man is going to kill him for the sins of another priest, a man who's been abused in the Catholic Church, says, I'm going to kill you, and you have until Sunday, basically. So the priest kind of spends his week as he normally would among his parishioners, who are all terrible people. They're despicable. They don't appreciate him at all. And the priest is actually a deeply good man. So the website movieguide.org says that Calvary, and this is quoting from the review, Calvary has a strong Christian worldview, and then defines Christian worldview as containing incidences of Christian church services, seeing people at prayer, Christian funeral, and the presence of hymn books and Bibles visually in the film. And then it says that Christian worldview is marred by the foul language, the strong references to Catholic abuse scandals, and one graphic scene of violence, which, again, in a film called Calvary, you might expect, given the shape of Christ's life, which is where Jesus died. So the website ChristianAnswers.net gives this film a sweeping morality rating of offensive. So the website, the most highly recommended titles, they can publish lists of them. A vast majority of them have overtly religious themes or plots. So the most highly rated films are, I've never seen any of these, but Heaven is for Real, The Nativity Story, and What If God Gave You a Second Chance. So just to say, you know, this, I think, exemplifies what I'm calling the exclude viewpoint. So first, as the viewers, we look for and identify certain markers of morality, or if you're a Christian, kind of Christian markers, such as people going to church or praying, and kind of balance them with the unpleasant or immoral elements that you see in the story. So then you draw a line between stories of good and evil. So you put stories into baskets. You would say, this is a story that's offensive, as ChristianAnswers.net said, and therefore I will not engage with it. And this is a story that is acceptable, that's morally acceptable, and I will engage with it. So does that make sense? You kind of say, this is good, this is bad, I will engage with these, I will disengage with the latter, and kind of navigate the difficulty of deciding what to watch or what to read in this way. So then a second viewpoint would be what I'm calling the engaged viewpoint. And to contrast that, you know, there's another Christian publication called Christianity Today, which also reviews films and does a lot of the similar things that movieguide.org does. Including mentioning, you know, here's what people might have issues with. Here might be some places where you touch some sensitivities. And the review of Calvary, I'm quoting from the review now. It says, the film sees the grace of God as something that is extended only to the unclean, the sick who need a physician, as Jesus said. So you see the author referring to these despicable people who are responsible for all of the foul language and for the lewd references to the Catholic abuse scandals. Those are all the townspeople that the priest is kind of interacting with and who ultimately he dies for in the end. So the Christianity Today review sees this as a parable of Christ's life and sees us in the place of these sinners and says that the movie succeeds as far as it shows us that we are among these despicable people and that we are like them, deserving or not undeserving of grace, but having received it from someone who was good. Another example that I've heard of the engaged viewpoint would be, you know, I heard of a pastor once who said to his church, you know, I don't have any restrictions on the things that my teenagers watch. He had two teenagers. Said, I don't restrict, you know, their film watching or their book reading, but I do insist on reading and watching everything with them. So we do it as a family. Whatever TV show all of their friends are into, I'm right there watching it with them, and I've got the remote control in my hand, and then as something comes across the screen, I can pause it and say, what do you think is happening here? Do you think these people are really in love? How do you feel about this interaction? Do you feel like, you know, that cruelty was taken seriously, or it was just passed off, or was made to seem cool, or something like that, so that they're in constant conversation about these narratives and are kind of pulling from them the good and the bad, teasing them out, deciding how to feel about them, untwisting them, which is a term that I'll use over the course of this lecture. So that would be a good example of what I'm calling the engage viewpoint. So that would be something that looks for and embraces truth wherever it might may be found, even if the story is 90% despicable and 10% glorious. You would grab that 10% and say, isn't this glorious? And so, you know, much like us, who are mixtures of light and dark, good and evil, a story is a mix of light and dark and good and evil, and you would see it in that way. So then our work is to discern the true and the untrue elements, or the good and the evil, or the moral and the immoral, and be edified by the process of identifying both. So rather than having baskets of two different kinds of stories, you would interact with each story as its own kind of body and understand that it has light and dark in it. So two approaches to engaging, both of which engage deeply, and I think are both very valid approaches. As I said earlier, I think that the engage viewpoint is a more powerful and perhaps accurate way of interacting with stories. And the reason that I feel this way, this is kind of exemplified by a little chart that I made. So as I was thinking about stories and thinking about aspects of immorality in them, I just made a list of sins and made a list of things that I find really horrifying. So rape, warfare, betrayal, social injustice, witchcraft, adultery, incest, suicide, beheading, prostitute mutilation, and child sacrifice. And then I just took some of my favorite stories and tried to see where they landed. So we have the Chronicles of Narnia, which is a beloved series of children's books by C.S. Lewis. Anna Karenina, great Russian classic. Macbeth, Shakespeare. Game of Thrones, which is the HBO show that has quite a bit of action and violence and sex and nudity and all of the immoral elements that we were discussing earlier. And then we have the Christian Bible. So we see here that Narnia, Anna Karenina, Macbeth, they all have kind of four or five counts against them. And then you have Game of Thrones, which is probably one of the most villainized shows on television currently. And it matches the Bible, sin for sin, if you will, including child sacrifice, prostitute mutilation, incest, things like this. And I don't do this to be cheeky, like I'm very serious about this, but I think my problem with the exclude viewpoint, the one that kind of looks for identifiable markers of morality or Christianity, is that it doesn't help you to see how a story deals with those elements of morality in its context. So if you would look at the Bible and Game of Thrones, they would both be equally offensive by that standard. So actually our question should be, how are these sins dealt with in the context of the story? What is being said about them? Because the Bible is filled with darkness. I think it's probably the darkest story I have ever read in many ways. If you just think about the presence of pain and betrayal and suffering. And yet, you know, Jesus says nothing will pass away from this book until everything has been accomplished. And John says nothing is to be added or taken away from it. The Psalms say that we're to meditate on it day and night. And that doesn't just mean the bits that make us feel good, but also, you know, the bits in Judges that include prostitute mutilation and things like that. So how do we reconcile that, this idea that I should be meditating on this every day? So I think what I'm just trying to say with this is that if the contents of the Bible fail the simple morality test of the presence of sin in a story, the presence of immoral elements in a story, then I think that there's something wrong with the test. There's this quote by Francis Schaeffer, who was the founder of Libri and who wrote quite a bit about engaging culturally. And he says, Bible-believing Christians should never have the reaction designated by the term shocked. There is a type of Christian who constantly draws himself or herself up and declares, I am shocked. If he is, he is not reacting to reality as he should. So what is reality? Would be the next question. So raise your hand if you have seen this curve so far this term. So this is just a quick foray into just the sort of structure of reality, the nature of reality as I see it as a Christian. So before we kind of unpack a little bit more of what I mean by this engaged viewpoint, I want to look at this, because this is sort of what we see as the structure for reality, and we teach this a lot at Libri, but it's also the structure that we have available to us for our stories. But God is a storyteller. I think that's very clear from the biblical account. He made the world. He said that he spoke it into being. Creation itself tells a story about who he is, says that in the Psalms. And then he gave us the Bible, which is this vast, sweeping, incredible narrative about who he is and who we are in relationship with him. And then when Jesus came to earth, he spoke in stories. He told parable after parable after parable. So clearly, stories are a major part of this creation that we get to live in. So we have this kind of four-part framework. So we have creation, the fall, redemption, and what I call consummation, but which is often called restoration. I just often get restoration and redemption too confused to have two R words there. So in the beginning, creation, you know, we have God in the garden with the people that he's made, a perfect world. The fall, humankind rebels, there's pain and suffering. A redemption, Christ comes and gives us hope, and consummation is a time of returning to perfect harmony in our relationship with the Lord. So that would be the 30-second version of kind of the biblical framework. But what I want to talk about is just how it relates to stories. If this is the stuff of creation and this is the stuff of stories. So in creation, you might see in a story this theme playing itself out in a utopia or innocence, perfect union, perfect contentment, the beginning of something. The fall would be represented in a story as discordance, pain, brokenness, evil, regrets. Redemption in a story would look like hope, the possibility of good, joy in the midst of suffering, connection with people despite everything, connection with God despite everything. And then consummation would look like total healing, deep fulfillment, the satisfaction of all of our longings. So I bring that up because my first point about why to engage with dark stories, why do this thing instead of creating different baskets of good and bad, why would we just kind of choose to engage the way that I'm suggesting? One is that fiction is a uniquely human art form. And Flannery O'Connor puts it really well. She says, fiction is so very much an incarnational art. Fiction is about everything human, and we are made of dust. And if you scorn getting yourself dusty, then you shouldn't try fiction. She's a very sassy lady. So what does it mean that fiction is an incarnational art? Fiction is unique from other art forms in the sense that it needs flesh to come to life. It needs someone's eyes, someone's ears, someone's sense of touch, someone's sense of taste in order to relay the story to you. So regardless of how you're watching it or listening to it or reading it, you're engaging with fiction as a human being in the world, and that's how it's being related to you. So this is different from painting, which can be quite abstract. It's different from music, which uses totally different rules of relating to us. So fiction is about us. It's about the world. Fiction doesn't work if it's three words on a page about nothing that are completely disconnected. So even fantasy and science fiction don't escape this. If you have a story about aliens, they are personified aliens with eyes and ears, or at least ways of sensing and feeling and reaching the world around them and relaying it to you, the reader, or you, the viewer, whatever it is. So a story must be realistic. It must be incarnational. It must have flesh on it in order to succeed. And by succeed, I just mean make sense to us. So the trouble with that is that our eyes and our ears and all of our senses and all of the things that we can perceive with them are broken. So I discussed the fall just a moment ago, and we are surrounded by difficulty and strife and pain. Not only difficulty, strife, and pain, but everything is touched by the fall. John Calvin had an idea called total depravity, which doesn't mean everything is the worst that it can possibly get. It means everything is touched by depravity. Everything has been touched by the fall after that initial rebellion. Nature, our relationships with one another, our feelings about ourselves. Everything is a bit off tune. Everything is touched by the fall. So because of that, no story can exclude the fall. If a story is incarnational in the sense that it comes down onto our earth and walks around looking at it and telling us something about it, then it cannot ignore the fact that the fall is real, which is a fact that we all know from very early childhood, whether we're Christians or not, that things don't always go the way that they ought to. Things don't always seem as good as they should. So stories must contain something of the fall. And then stories must also contain something of redemption. So that's the one right after the fall on the curve. So that's also something we've experienced. And again, this is very common sense. We know that there's also joy in our lives. We know that there are unexpected, wonderful things that happen. We know that there's hope. So no story can ignore either of these two things, because that's simply the world in which we live. It's called, an English term that we have for it is the already and not yet. So we have hope and yet it's not fulfilled quite yet. We're still struggling with brokenness, and yet we have hope that everything will be healed. So this is where we dwell. None of us saw creation, and none of us in this room has seen consummation. So fiction necessarily takes place in this part of the curve. We can imagine our way into either of those spaces. You can sort of dream about what things might have looked like in the beginning when there was no sin. And you can dream about what it might look like with consummation. And fiction does do that, although the better authors are very careful about it. Even Tolkien, who wrote probably the most epic book of all time, The Lord of the Rings, he, at the end of it, just lets Frodo and Gandalf go off to the Grey Lands. He doesn't follow them there. He doesn't try to describe it, because I think he knows that on some level it would be impossible to relay. Why else? Why engage with dark stories? So we could have a long conversation on what a good story is, or a great story, and what a story that falls short of greatness is. But I think that a good story is one that tells the truth, or a valuable story, or a story that is art, or a story that is effective, or a story that moves us, is one that tells something true about the world. And that could be a small truth, or it could be a broad, sweeping truth. Another thing that Flannery O'Connor says is, I'm always highly irritated by people who imply that fiction is an escape from reality, which is a common thing, isn't it? You sort of escape away into fiction. She says it's a plunge into reality, and it's very shocking to the system. So if I say that a good story tells the truth and a bad story, for lack of a better term, tells a lie, what I mean is, how close does that story actually draw near to this reality that Flannery O'Connor is talking about? How close is it to offering us a glimpse of either, you know, the true human lived experience, or something transcendent, something to do with the very bones of the universe and its laws and the things that we cannot see but that we know to be somehow true. So an example, just a very simple example, would be a tree. Like, if there's a story that includes a description of a tree, and we recognize that description as a tree, so it has green leaves in the summer, it has roots that go into the ground, it has bark, it's brown, then that story has succeeded in telling us something true about the world, and that story is a bit more powerful for us as a result. We trust it a bit more. If it includes a very inaccurate description of a tree that either shows us that the author has no regard for what a tree looks like, or has never seen one, or not the skill to describe it well, then we lose a bit of something. It's not as good of a story in the sense that I'm talking about. So I'm not talking so much about craft as I am about content, although there is a good discussion to be had about how to communicate effectively. So you can also take something that's less concrete, but that's still a real part of our world. So like the concept of cruelty. You can't see cruelty the way that you see a tree, but a story that shows cruelty as it truly is, we would all recognize as cruelty, because we've seen it. We know what cruelty is. So that story succeeds as it's able to convey cruelty to us in a way that we recognize and instinctively resonate with and say, yes, that's it. As opposed to, well, that doesn't seem that bad. Why is everybody so upset? The story has failed a bit there. Or has done something intentional. So a bad story in this sense might lie unintentionally, because the writer doesn't truly understand cruelty or a tree, or it might be an intentional lie. You could argue with me about this, but I believe that Ayn Rand's book, Atlas Shrugged, takes something that we would call selfishness and calls it unselfishness in a way that's very convincing, because she's an incredible writer, but very confusing, and sort of replaces a definition very, very intentionally in order to sort of change our concept of what selfishness or unselfishness is. And then just another little side note to this is just the question of what a Christian story is, which is a complicated term, and that's because Christian was originally a word used to denote a person who was a follower of Christ. And so I find it not always so helpful, although it is a very helpful sort of marketing category or category for things that if you're looking for something in the bookstore, it's helpful to have a Christian section, for example. But I find that I don't always understand it. You know, what is a Christian story any more than this is like a Christian lectern, or this is a Christian desk, or this is a Christian computer? You know, is it a Christian lectern because it's in a Christian place, or because it was made by a Christian a long time ago, or because it's well made, or because it has like a Bible verse on it that evangelizes to me as I sit here? Those are all questions that I have about this term, but I think maybe a helpful way to think about Christian stories would be, in what sense is the story like Christ, Christ-likeness? And I think Christ engaged deeply with our darkness. I think he didn't take the exclude approach. He was God. He came to earth. He made himself human, and he met us in our darkness, and from this common place, he redeemed us. There's something that the author, or it's an artist, a Japanese artist in working in New York, says. He's a Christian, does beautiful abstract work, and his name's Makoto Fujimura. And he says I want to get the quote right. All art can be enjoyed, critiqued, and even untwisted for the glory of God. All art can be enjoyed, critiqued, and even untwisted for the glory of God. And I love that, because as I think about a story in its Christ-likeness, Jesus untwisted this world when he came into it. He untwisted us. It's just another word for redemption. And so we, in his name, can untwist the things in our culture, our relationships and our stories, we can say, no, it shouldn't have been this way. It should have been another way. Even identifying an untruth is a way of pointing out a truth. This is another significant point for me in terms of why to engage with dark stories, which is the idea that we've been redeemed at great cost. Flannery O'Connor, these words on the screen, she wrote after commenting on that letter that she received from the woman in California. So she said, this was her answer to why the woman's heart should have been uplifted. There is something in us as storytellers and as listeners to stories that demands the redemptive act, that demands that what falls at least be offered the chance to be restored. The reader of today looks for this motion, and rightly so, but what he has forgotten is the cost of it. His sense of evil is diluted or lacking altogether, and so he has forgotten the price of restoration. I think this, for me, is the, although I've talked about biblical worldview and a number of things that are unique to sort of the Christian viewpoint, I think this, for me, is really the crux of it, why I can engage with a story that impacts me in a way that's painful. This reason in itself, I think I can never get away from the fact that it was my sin, and then through Christ's death and his blood, that I get to celebrate as a Christian at all. And so I have difficulty perhaps with the argument of, well, we're Christians, shouldn't we be happy and shouldn't we be celebrating? I would say yes, but we're celebrating because we were brought through great darkness, and I've known that darkness and I've seen it, and I'm celebrating because I'm not bound to it. So the movement of the Christian life is from darkness into the light. And that is a movement that you see in Christ's life as well, that he was tempted in every way that we were, that he lived among us, that he was betrayed by his friends, that he watched people die, that he was hungry, that he was afraid. So even Christ, who we would say is the sort of perfect Christian, he's the model for sinlessness. He was the second Adam. He went through a lot of difficulty and felt that difficulty. It said that before the cross, he wept tears of blood. Before the tomb of Lazarus, although he knew he was going to raise him, he cried. He wept. And so he felt the pain of this world. And that encourages me to feel it as well without fear. And then, you know, for those of you who are listening to Philip read the story about the woman whose leg was stolen, I think I find this point about redemption really comforting in the sense that I recognize myself in the darkness of stories. Like, I am that woman with a wooden leg who has a hard part of her soul that I treasure more than my very own soul, and I'm not willing to let go of it unless someone in great grace and mercy takes it away from me. So we recognize ourselves in stories like this, and it's a strange thing to say, but I think that it can be deeply comforting. That was Flannery O'Connor's point. We can be uplifted because we're as bad as those people she's writing about, and yet they were offered a chance at grace. They were offered a chance at healing. They were what falls, and they were offered the chance to be restored. And I think she felt that we ought to be uplifted because we are too. Okay, last point on this. One of the most helpful things about taking the engage approach is that we become a bit freer, I think, to identify difficult or destructive worldviews or patterns in unexpected places. So it's really easy, I think, to look at a story that disturbs us or frightens us and say, ugh, that's, you know, I don't want to engage with that. That's bad. But I think that sometimes the things that feel good aren't necessarily good. So I don't mean to harp on Disney. This is a from the film Pinocchio, which actually has a lot of really beautiful things in it about belonging and home. And so there, I'm not throwing it out. I'm not making a basket and saying this is in the evil category. But I'm saying when I was a child, I watched lots of Disney movies. I watched this all the time. And when I looked at these lyrics, I recognized that I believed this. So we have here When You Wish Upon a Star, which is the kind of famous song from Pinocchio. And the lyrics say, when you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. If your heart is in your dreams, no request is too extreme when you wish upon a star as dreamers do. Fate is kind. She brings to those who love the sweet fulfillment of their secret longing. Like a bolt out of the blue, fate steps in and sees you through. When you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. So that does not reflect any experience that I've ever had in my life. I don't know about you, but that's not true. Like, that's not true. That's not how this works. And I don't know. Like, I've met a lot of people who have sort of absorbed that kind of thinking and then get to adulthood and find themselves very disappointed in life, or if they're Christians, in God, because he's not the fate that steps in like a bolt out of the blue to give you whatever you want. Like, so I would say this is a very lovely movie, and it's very good for children in the sense that there's no
nudity.
Yeah, there's no nudity in Pinocchio. We know that for sure. But this is a destructive worldview that I think if we kind of just use those broad categories that we would miss this, and I missed this, and yeah, I've had to sort of deal with the disappointment that comes with reworking how life actually works. It's not a Disney movie. And I think it would have been helpful to have a bit more of a framework for, maybe what feels bad doesn't mean the thing is bad, and maybe what feels good doesn't mean the thing is good. So you might feel bad if you, say, see cruelty depicted truly, as it truly is, what raw cruelty is. We should feel terrible when we watch that or read it. And that's a good thing. That means the categories are correct. Cruelty is a terrible force in the world. And if we feel bad after seeing that, if we feel in pain, if we feel anger, if we feel a desire for justice, then I would say that story has done something right, and we should celebrate it. We should say, yes, like, this is a story about cruelty. And so we're kind of freed from conflating our feelings with the story. Does that make sense? So this feels good, it must be good. This feels bad, it must be bad. We don't have to just deal in those categories, but we can actually say, well, my feelings could be saying, you know, that there's actually something very true going on here, or my feelings could be saying, you know, this is a lie, but it feels really good to believe. I do want to make a note. This is my note about sensitivities, which I'm sure a lot of you have been thinking of as I've been talking. And yeah, I just want you to know that this is a really important point. It's really important to me. I've spoken with a lot of people about it. And I would say that some of us have very good reason for excluding stories, either for a season of life or for our entire lives, depending on who we are and what kind of experiences that we've had. Children are a great example. Children may not have developed the capacity to untwist a story yet. My child psychologist friend Tom Smiley says that before a certain age, a child does not have an ability to understand that a story is going to resolve itself. So they live in the present of the story as if that's all that there is. So if it's one of those films that has a very scary thing happening with a monster in it, even if it's a, you know, very child-friendly one, we as adults know, yeah, this scary thing's going to happen, but we know how narrative works. You know, the good guys are going to get away, and then everything's going to be all right. But a child actually can't understand that. They feel that as if that is all there is, and that's not good for them. It's traumatizing, actually. So there could be very good reason for excluding stories like that from a child until they have developed the ability to know this is going to be okay or this isn't real. There are also, you know, we're adults here, but we also have different sensitivities, experiences that we've had that prevent us from untwisting the story. That could be history of abuse or violence, pornography, romantic ideation. I know I have a friend who just can't watch chick flicks because it's not, she struggles with romantic ideation, and those films feed something that's quite unhealthy. And she recognizes that she can't enjoy them the way many other people do, and that actually she can't interact with them the way that they're meant to be. So just to say, you know, I think that it is appropriate to use wisdom and discernment depending on who you are or how old you are. Draw boundaries, engage carefully. I would say, you know, maybe the measure for what a sensitivity is versus, you know, how painful it is to see cruelty. Because the more sensitive we are to reality, I think the more sensitive we are to the reality of violence, for example, which is something that's in a lot of films. Actually, the more we recognize, like, wow, this affected a family, this affected, you know, this person's children who just got killed, or, you know, whatever, we'll actually feel more pain as a result of recognizing the reality of what that narrative is saying. So I would say a measure of sensitivity is not actually like, oh, that was really painful, but maybe more along the lines of, like, do you get stuck? Can you not, like that child who can't see anything beyond, do you get stuck in that pain, or do you get stuck in the pornographic elements of something like Game of Thrones? Do you get stuck in the romantic ideation without an ability to kind of get past it? I was, you know, discussing this lecture with a former Libri student who gave to me an example of a sensitivity that she has with violence, where we'd seen an archaeology lecture the night before, and in the lecture there was a stone with a carving on it where they showed, it was a sort of war depiction on the carving, and there were images of men whose legs had been broken. And she gave that as an example that... that it sort of entered the current of a series of obsessive thoughts, and she would be at breakfast and that image of the broken legs would just come to her, and then at night when she was going to bed she would dream of it, and that she got stuck in this loop of seeing these broken legs, and it culminated in drawing more and more images into her mind. So that would be a good example of just getting quite stuck. That would be a great example of a person that's sensitive to bodily violence and should be careful about the things that she watches, simply because she can't get out of that cycle. Once she gets into it, it's very hard. But if we can, I think there are some benefits to engaging with the fallen stories, and these I'll just zip through really quick, and then we're going to listen to a story together. Just to say, the fall is real, and I think it's worthwhile for a story to give us a glimpse of the world either as it is or as we can sometimes see it. It's as fiction is a very human art, I think it can be a bit comforting to look at a story and say, you too, this is how it feels to me sometimes as well. So I was thinking of Psalm 73, which says, I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked, for they have no pangs until death. Their bodies are fat and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are. They are not stricken like the rest of mankind. Behold, these are the wicked. Always at ease, they increase in riches. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. Is that the whole truth about the world? That, you know, the wicked are doing great and it's pointless to be innocent, it's pointless to be good? No, that's not the whole truth. Is that how it feels sometimes? Yeah. I think it's wonderful that psalm is in the Bible. I think it is incredibly comforting to just think, yeah, sometimes it feels like we are fighting what it says in Lord of the Rings, a long defeat. What's the point of being good? Sometimes it does feel that way. So that's a tiny little slice of the truth of human experience. But how wonderful that our stories can reflect that. Next one is, when we see injustice, we yearn for justice. I think... Well, an example of this would be in 2 Samuel, you have David, King David, who's just committed adultery and then just had the woman's husband killed in order to cover it up. And then the prophet Nathan comes to him and says, I'm going to tell you a story, basically, and says, you know, well, he doesn't tell him he's going to tell him a story. Actually, he pretends like it's real. And he says, this long-winded story about a rich man who has a lot of livestock and then this poor man who has this little ewe lamb that he treats like a daughter and that lives with him in the house and that's very precious to him. And then he continues with the story, you know, a traveler comes to the rich man and the rich man has all this livestock, but instead of killing one of them, he goes to this poor guy and takes his little ewe lamb and kills it and feeds it to the traveler. And David gets furious. He's so angry and he just starts storming about how this man needs to die and he needs to pay that poor man for, you know, the lamb four times over. And then Nathan just stops him and say, "That's you. I'm talking about you. You are the man," he says. He is the man that took something precious from someone poor, something that was singular and that meant nothing to David, who had all of these wives, and meant everything to this man. And David in that moment is convicted and repents and in a way that he had not up until that point. So it was through this story of injustice, of great injustice, that David's heart was moved toward justice. And somehow I have to think that, you know, if Nathan had walked in the door and said, "I'm going to tell you a story, David. There was a man who was very rich and he did everything right and he never trespassed on anyone else's stuff and he never took what wasn't his and he never," I don't know if David would have had the same reaction of repentance. If he had just walked in and told him a happy story, I think he would have just been like, "Great for that guy." But there's something about us, isn't there, that is moved when something goes wrong. We want to see it put right. Those stories are incredibly powerful. I think that stories of goodness are also very powerful. So I'm not discounting those at all. I can think of stories that have moved me in amazing ways that were just a picture of something beautiful or something hopeful. But it is also true that great injustice moves us to justice. We want to see things put right. There's an instinct in us that activates. There's the prophetic aspect of stories, which I think, Marnie, you're reading 1984. That would be a good example of the prophetic in stories, which is a sort of author or a writer looking at the current culture and kind of stretching it way into the future and saying, this is where we will go. It's a very doomsday thing, you know. This is where we will go if we continue or if we don't take care of one another, if we don't change. So it acts as a kind of prophetic warning, looking at the future and saying, this is where you're headed unless you turn around. So 1984 is a book that's a good example of that. Brave New World is a good example of that. And even Lord of the Rings, actually, which we kind of think of as like this epic, sweeping, you know, very Christian-influenced narrative. But Tolkien himself says that the reason he wrote The Lord of the Rings was to warn people about the devastation that modern warfare had on the land and its people. He was writing it during World War II and published it some years after. And he said himself, "This is what I was trying to do. I was, you know, trying to warn our culture about what these two world wars in a row were doing to us and doing to our land." So that would be the prophetic element. And then lastly, we stretch our moral imaginations inside these stories. With empathy, we learn how to deal with the fall in our own lives. I think that's the power of stories, isn't it? That we truly enter them. And even there's branches of psychology and neuroscience that deal with narratives and that show that, you know, the same parts of our brains that are activated in real social interactions are activated as we're engaging with stories. So as we do that, we are very possibly changed and formed by those experiences that we have in a story context. I can think of reading, you know, this book called The Yearling when I was a child before any pet of mine had ever died. And it's about a young boy who has a pet deer who dies. And I mourned that deer as if it were my own. And I think it set a stage for what grief is and what death is and what it looks like in a very real way that had an impact on my actual life. It doesn't just stay in the story world, the lessons that we learn there, but they come with us. And so I think that the way that we engage with the fall as we see it in stories is mirrored in how we engage with pain and the fall in our own lives. So All that being said, we have, yeah, I'm just going to do it. So it's a 10-minute story, but I thought it'd be helpful to, like, just put this to practice, like, in a practical way, and just listen to a story together that's of the kind that I'm talking about. It's just a 10-minute story, something that was published in the New Yorker in 95, a story that I quite like. But I thought that that would be kind of a helpful way of putting the ideas. I'm going to just take one and pass it. So I have a printed copy of it. If you prefer to just listen, that's fine too, but it can be helpful to follow along. What should you know about this story? So this is, it was published in 1995. It's by a writer called Tobias Wolff. It was published in the New Yorker, which is big magazine in New York that does a lot of like new fiction and poetry and things like that. Very contemporary. And it's about a man who is a book critic who has lost all sense of reality and beauty and connection with other people, and then he gets shot in the head. So that's the story. Like, it's called Bullet in the Brain. So again, I'm not spoiling anything for you. So as you can tell, there's not a lot of redemptive material, but I think as we listen to it, you'll hopefully find that there is. So I will I'll push play on it. Let's see. Does everyone have one that wants one? All right. So I'm just going to hit it. He goes right into it. It's just an oral reading.
Anders couldn't get to the bank until just before it closed. So, of course, the line was endless, and he got stuck behind two women whose loud, stupid conversation put him in a murderous temper. He was never in the best of tempers anyway, Anders. A book critic known for the weary, elegant savagery with which he dispatched almost everything he reviewed. With the line still doubled around the rope, one of the tellers stuck a position closed sign in her window and walked to the back of the bank, where she leaned against the desk and began to pass the time with a man shuffling papers. The women in front of Anders broke off their conversation and watched the teller with hatred. "Oh, that's nice," one of them said. She turned to Anders and added, confident of his accord, "One of those little human touches that keeps us coming back for more." Anders had conceived his own towering hatred of the teller, but he immediately turned it on the presumptuous crybaby in front of him. "Damned unfair," he said. "Tragic, really. If they're not chopping you off the wrong leg or bombing your ancestral village, they're closing their positions." She stood her ground. "I didn't say it was tragic," she said. "I just think it's a pretty lousy way to treat your customers." "Unforgivable," Anders said. "Heaven will take note." She sucked in her cheeks, but stared past him and said nothing. Anders saw that the other woman, her friend, was looking in the same direction. And then the tellers stopped what they were doing, and the customers slowly turned, and silence came over the bank. Two men wearing black ski masks and blue business suits were standing to the side of the door. One of them had a pistol pressed against the guard's neck. The guard's eyes were closed, and his lips were moving. The other man had a sawed-off shotgun. "Keep your big mouth shut," the man with the pistol said, though no one had spoken a word. "One of you tellers hits the alarm, you're all dead meat. Got it?" The tellers nodded. "Oh, bravo," Anders said. "Dead meat." He turned to the woman in front of him. "Great script, huh? The stern, brass-knuckled poetry of the dangerous classes." She looked at him with drowning eyes. The man with the shotgun pushed the guard to his knees. He handed the shotgun to his partner and yanked the guard's wrists up behind his back and locked them together with a pair of handcuffs. He toppled him onto the floor with a kick between the shoulder blades. Then he took his shotgun back and went over to the security gate at the end of the counter. He was short and heavy and moved with peculiar slowness, even torpor. "Buzz him in," the partner said. The man with the shotgun opened the gate and sauntered along the line of tellers, handing each of them a hefty bag. When he came to the empty position, he looked over at the man with the pistol, who said, "Whose slot is that?" Anders watched the teller. She put her hand to her throat and turned to the man she'd been talking to. He nodded. Mine, she said. Then get your ugly ass in gear and fill that bag. There you go, Anders said to the woman in front of him. Justice is done. Hey, right boy, did I tell you to talk? No, Anders said. Then shut your trap. Did you hear that? Anders said. Right boy, right out of the killers. Please be quiet, the woman said. Hey, you deaf or what? The man with the pistol walked over to Anders. He poked the weapon into Anders' gut. You think I'm playing games? No, Anders said. But the barrel tickled like a stiff finger, and he had to fight back the titters. He did this by making himself stare into the man's eyes, which were clearly visible behind the holes in the mask, pale blue and rawly red-rimmed. The man's left eyelid kept twitching. He breathed out a piercing, ammoniac smell that shocked Anders more than anything that had happened, and he was beginning to develop a sense of unease when the man prodded him again with the pistol. You like me, bright boy? No, Anders said. Then stop looking at me. Anders fixed his gaze on the man's shiny wingtip shoes. Not down there, up there. He stuck the pistol under Anders' chin and pushed it upward until Anders was looking at the ceiling. Anders had never paid much attention to that part of the bank, a pompous old building with marble floors and counters and pillars and gilt scrollwork over the teller's cages. The domed ceiling had been decorated with mythological figures whose fleshy, toga-draped ugliness Anders had taken in at a glance many years earlier and afterward declined to notice. Now he had no choice but to scrutinize the painter's work. It was even worse than he'd remembered, and all of it executed with the utmost gravity. The artist had a few tricks up his sleeve and used them again and again, a certain rosy blush on the undersides of the clouds, a coy backward glance on the faces of the cupids and fauns. The ceiling was crowded with various dramas, but the one that caught Anders's eye was Zeus and Europa, portrayed in this rendition as a bull ogling a cow from behind a haystack. To make the cow sexy, the painter had canted her hips suggestively and given her long, droopy eyelashes, through which she gazed back at the bull with sultry welcome. The bull wore a smirk, and his eyebrows were arched. If there'd been a bubble coming out of his mouth, it would have said, hubba hubba. What's so funny, bright boy? Nothing. You think I'm comical? You think I'm some kind of clown? No. Your history, capiche? Anders burst out laughing. He covered his mouth with both hands and said, I'm sorry, then snorted helplessly through his fingers and said, capiche? Oh, God, capiche? And at that, the man with the pistol raised the pistol and shot Anders right in the head. The bullet smashed Anders' skull and plowed through his brain and exited behind the right ear, scattering shards of bone into the cerebral cortex, the corpus callosum, back toward the basal ganglia and down into the thalamus. But before all this occurred, the first appearance of the bullet in the cerebrum set off a crackling chain of ion transports and neurotransmissions. Because of their peculiar origin, these traced a peculiar pattern, flukishly calling to life a summer afternoon some 40 years past and long since lost to memory. After striking the cranium, the bullet was moving at 900 feet per second, a pathetically sluggish, glacial pace compared to the synaptic lightning that flashed around it. Once in the brain, that is, the bullet came under the mediation of brain time, which gave Anders plenty of leisure to contemplate the scene that, in a phrase he would have abhorred, passed before his eyes. It is worth noting what Anders did not remember, given what he did remember. He did not remember his first lover, Sherry, or what he had most madly loved about her before it came to irritate him, her unembarrassed carnality. Anders did not remember his wife, whom he had also loved before she exhausted him with her predictability, or his daughter, now a sullen professor of economics at Dartmouth. He did not remember standing just outside his daughter's door as she lectured her bear about his naughtiness and described the truly appalling punishments Paws would receive unless he changed his ways. He did not remember a single line of the hundreds of poems he had committed to memory in his youth so that he could give himself the shivers at will. Not, silent upon a peak in Darien, or, my God, I heard this day, or, all my pretty ones? Did you say all? Oh, hell kite, all? None of these did he remember, not one. Anders did not remember his dying mother saying of his father, I should have stabbed him in his sleep. He did not remember Professor Josephs telling his class how Athenian prisoners in Sicily had been released if they could recite Aeschylus, and then reciting Aeschylus himself right there in the Greek. Anders did not remember how his eyes had burned at those sounds. He did not remember the surprise of seeing a college classmate's name on the jacket of a novel not long after they graduated, or the respect he had felt after reading the book. He did not remember the pleasure of giving respect. Nor did Anders remember seeing a woman leap to her death from the building opposite his own just days after his daughter was born. He did not remember shouting, "Lord, have mercy." He did not remember deliberately crashing his father's car into a tree, or having his ribs kicked in by three policemen at an anti-war rally, or waking himself up with laughter. He did not remember when he began to regard the heap of books on his desk with boredom and dread, or when he grew angry at writers for writing them. He did not remember when everything began to remind him of something else. This is what he remembered. Heat. A baseball field. Yellow grass, the whir of insects, himself leaning against a tree as the boys of the neighborhood gather for a pickup game. He looks on as the others argue the relative genius of Mantle and Mays. They have been worrying this subject all summer, and it has become tedious to Anders, an oppression like the heat. Then the last two boys arrive, Coyle and a cousin of his from Mississippi. Anders has never met Coyle's cousin before and will never see him again. He says hi with the rest of them, but takes no further notice of them, until they've chosen sides and someone asks the cousin what position he wants to play. "Shortstop," the boy says. "Short's the best position they is." Anders turns and looks at him. He wants to hear Coyle's cousin repeat what he's just said, but he knows better than to ask. The others will think he's being a jerk, ragging the kid for his grammar. But that isn't it. Not at all. It's that Anders is strangely roused, elated by those final two words, their pure unexpectedness, and their music. He takes the field in a trance, repeating them to himself. The bullet is already in the brain. It won't be outrun forever or charmed to a halt. In the end, it will do its work and leave the troubled skull behind, dragging its comet's tail of memory and hope and talent and love into the marble hall of commerce. That can't be helped. But for now, Anders can still make time. Time for the shadows to lengthen on the grass. Time for the tethered dog to bark at the flying ball. Time for the boy in right field to smack his sweat-blackened mitt and softly chant, "They is. They is. They is."
Gary, do you want to pop that off for me? Just the black one. Yeah, should be to the left. Alright, so just to do a bit of story analysis, as a way of starting off our discussion, here's another curve, which is a very typical narrative curve, which if you took writing classes or something, you've seen something like this. So the beginning of a story, these are just the components that a story ought to include, in order to sort of make sense to us. So in the beginning, it's often called the setting, but basically it just establishes reality in the world that you've been let into. It establishes a bit of consistency, coherency. We can recognize it either as a place we've been or understand, or a place we've never been and never understand, where there might be new rules. But this is a very kind of concrete reality we're brought into. We're standing in a bank with Anders, in probably New York. Then as the story moves on, you have what's called rising action, which I think is a bit of a misnomer in the sense that that just expects that the story gets suddenly exciting or something like that. But I think it's better put that you have the introduction of a kind of pressure. So in order to have a story, you need some sort of pressure that comes in, whether an internal or external pressure on your main character or characters, that's going to force the climax, which is at the top of the curve, which is some sort of change. So the pressure becomes so great, again, interior, exterior, and then some sort of change is exacted in the character by this pressure. And after that, we have the falling action, which is the working out of that change, which can be short or long. And then the conclusion, bringing us to an altered reality, either slightly altered or greatly altered. So we know our reality that we're given. We are with a book critic, a seemingly very sort of cynical man. A lot of the references that he makes are to cliches from films or art. He's perhaps seen a lot of cliches in his life, and he can't even bring himself to be bothered by the teller sort of leaving the position as the women in front of him complain about it. He sort of scoffs at them rather than connecting with them over it. So, rising action, what is the pressure that's introduced into the story? Mm-hmm. Yep, the robbers come into the bank, right? So something's going to happen. This is not a normal day at the bank. There's a pressure that's been introduced, and we can sense that Anders is our main character, and there's going to be something that happens with him. It wouldn't be a story if the robbers walked in and they just walked back out again, and everybody went back to what they were doing before. Okay, so now this one's trickier, so we can throw out a few ideas, but what do you think is the climax in the story? What did you say?
The bullet.
So the bullet, that is that would be a sort of typical climax in terms of that's the most dramatic thing that happens. But I would say that the climax comes before the bullet is put into his brain and that actually the bullet is part of the falling action. Mm-hmm. Does anyone have any guesses as to the climax? Otherwise I'll have somebody read the paragraph. I don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but... What? Getting closer. So when he's interacting with the gunman. Does someone want to read me the paragraph where he's looking into the gunman's blue eyes? I don't have my copy with me, so I'm beholden to you.
He did this by making himself stare into the man's eyes, which were clearly visible behind the holes in the mask, pale blue and rawly red-rimmed. The man's left eyelid kept twitching. He breathed out a piercing
ammoniac.
That smell that shocked Anders more than anything that had happened. And it was beginning to develop a sense of unease.
That's it. Mm. There's your climax. So that is the moment where Anders changes. So Anders, up until that point, has been totally disconnected from reality, in a way that breaks my heart. He doesn't even seem to realize that he's in danger after the robbers come in. So caught up is he in the fact that they're speaking in cliches. He doesn't seem to recognize that even if they're speaking in cliches from old shoot 'em up movies, they're still there with real guns. He seems completely disconnected from that. He's laughing. He's putting other people in danger. You can see the woman in front of him in line is terrified. It says she looks at him with drowning eyes. She's crying. And yet he's thinking about the art on the ceiling on the wall or on the ceiling in the bank, and he's making fun of the language that the robbers are using because he's heard it all before. But when he looks into the man's eyes, it says it shocked him more than anything had up until that point, and he was just beginning to develop a sense of unease. So Anders comes briefly into reality, which is you're in danger, you're in a bank. This is not a joke. This is not a movie. This is not a book. You're not okay. So he touches reality. The unease is a true feeling that he ought to have and that one of us would have in that situation. So something breaks through that shell, that cynical shell that he wears. And I think that that is the change that's exacted by those robbers. But he doesn't change enough to save his life. And the falling action is that he laughs again and that the robber puts the bullet in his brain. And then we get this beautiful conclusion, which is a review of the things that he did not remember and then the thing that he did remember. So we get this glimpse into who Anders was before he was the person that we met today. What phases, thinking back to our other curve, our kind of creation, fall, redemption, consummation curve, and how I was talking about, you know, a story might occupy slices of this curve, you know, an epic would occupy or attempt to, you know, go from creation all the way to consummation, kind of like how Lord of the Rings does. But Psalm 73 gives us just a very thin slice of the fall when it talks about the wicked. So which of those can you see in this story? It's more than one of them.
I feel like at the end, it's almost just creation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So one of the themes of creation would be sort of origins, like beauty, like where you came from, a kind of utopia or innocence. So it goes back into his childhood and explores innocence. So that's definitely a note of creation, definitely. We have the fall, obviously, that's what we're mostly occupying, I would say. Anders is terrible, the teller is terrible, the ladies are terrible, you know, nobody, there's no hero in here that I can see at all. So we're occupying the fall. And then what about redemption? Is there any hope in this story?
The fact that he's become a critic, and then at the very end, the thing that he thought was so beautiful was something that he would criticize for bad grammar, but this is what captures him mm-hmm. and his imagination as a small boy, and that's the element of redemption.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that he should critique? Mm-hmm. That is what's most beautiful to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely say so. I would say that it's important when we're thinking about engaging with fiction in this way that a climax, so a change in the character, does not have to be a conversion. So this story, we shouldn't have the requirement that in order to succeed or in order for us to feel like there was hope in it, that he would have just turned around and said, no, I'm going to live my life in a different way. I'm going to give respect and I'm leaving now and thank you for this good lesson. You know, goodbye. Like, that shouldn't be our requirement. A change doesn't have to be a conversion. But I think this, what we have here is the possibility of redemption, which I think is held with this very open hand, both in the sense that he has this glimpse of reality, he begins to develop a sense of unease, and then this glimpse that we get of his life when he would recite poetry to give himself the chills at will, and when he listened to his professor and his eyes burned, and when he was just a little child and he heard just this musical sort of grammatical nuance of a southern accent and was entranced by it and fell in love with it. And that's what led him, you know, to do book reviews. And, you know, he did not remember the pleasure of giving respect, but he once did. And even if it's a sad story in the sense that it ends saying, you know, there's no time for Anders, you know, he's not saved, the bullet is going to do his work, but we as the readers are given this story that says his life was beautiful and he saw beauty and it could have been beautiful and he lost his way. Mm-hmm. And so that possibility of his goodness and of his redemption, I would argue, is the same as the presence of goodness and redemption in a story, even if the character did not grasp it. It still says that it exists, that beauty exists. And when I hear those memories, my heart is drawn to them and I feel incredibly sad for him. So just to finally finish, and I'll just put this on the screen. This is mixing media a little bit, so sorry for introducing painting. But this is a painting by George Frederick Watts. It's called Hope. And ever since I saw this painting for the first time, it's really stuck with me in the sense that I think sometimes we can think that hope should be this shining, triumphant, you know, wonderful thing, you know, saying to people, oh, I'm not down, I have hope, I'm not worried, I have hope. But then this painter kind of takes this image of hope in a totally different direction. I mean, she's wearing this ragged dress, she's playing a harp with just one broken string left. She's beaten and weary. She's either bandaged or blindfolded. And I find this to be an incredibly encouraging view of hope that I hope we can apply to our stories, which is to say that hope does not exclude deep pain. And the difference between hope and despair in a story or in our lives is not the lack or the presence of pain. This story is hopeful, there's nothing painful in it. This story is despair and it's filled with pain. But actually hope and despair both contain deep pain. The difference is that hope enfolds pain and transforms pain and isn't destroyed by pain. If you think of Psalm 23, you know, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, but I will fear no evil. It's not because we don't see the evil. It's not because we're closing our eyes and refusing to see the evil. It's because we have a sense that God is with us, and that on the other side of this dark valley is green pastures and a wedding feast and something that will heal all of our wounds. So we do not, in stories or in life, find ourselves unaffected by the fall, but rather through that darkness we enter into light, and we have that hope because we have Christ. And I think that that's how our hearts can be lifted up, not because we don't feel the pain of our stories or of the people around us or of our lives, but because somehow that pain can be transformed, and we believe that that's true. So with that image and with that very long lecture, do you have any questions or comments or something that you want to push back on, which I welcome? Or do you just want to go to bed? You can just go to bed if you really want to go to bed. But if you want to talk, we can stay and talk. Yeah, Emma.
So I think that a lot of this is a learned skill, just how to engage with the darkness in the stories and the eye twist and all of that. And like the kid, you know, the kids, it's more obvious because they're children. But I think you can make it to however old we are and still not have learned that skill to just dive into a really dark story. Without the skills, could be equally traumatic. So how do we grow in that skill?
That's a great question. I'm remembering the first time I ever saw the film Requiem for a Dream. Has anyone ever seen that film? It's a very dark film. It's a very, very dark film. It's incredibly true about what addiction is and what it does to people. It's very worthy. But the first time I watched it was just like, you know, in the top 50 movies that you should see in life, and I had like one of those Netflix, you know, subscription accounts where you like drop the DVD in the mail, and I was 17 and I just watched it in my basement like all alone. And I remember after it finished, I was just like, like, what do I do with that? I don't know what to do with that. It was horrible. I've been there, like just having no tools in front of me for how to deal with this dark, deep story. So I think, you know, in the context of community, we, you know, one of the reasons that we do film nights here at La Brea is so that we can discuss them together and kind of learn that muscle of like not like disengaging from our emotions, because I think emotions are a really important part of what it means to interact with a story, but add to those emotions some rationality. So what we just did with that story is something that, you know, I drew out a diagram for, but which is something that we try to do here at La Brea. It can be harder outside of a space like this, but yeah, we would try to, you know, instead of getting like dinner with friends before the movie and then peacing out afterwards, we would try to like see an early film or a matinee and then have dinner after so that we could kind of talk about it and process whatever it is. Because there's nothing worse than kind of getting up in the movie theater after you've seen something really intense or heavy and then just being like, I liked it, bye guys, and then getting in your car and going home. It's a really strange experience, so we need something to kind of guide us from that story space back into our normal life. So that was something we found that worked really well just when we were living in Chicago, just like even just creating the space to talk about it, even if you don't quite have the skills for like measuring, okay, where was the climax, or where, you know, what was the story saying about this. It at least gives you kind of an open hour and a half to kind of explore. And I think people are really interested in that, especially as now, it's strange, it's like the quality of particularly visual media, like television, is incredibly high at this point, the quality of narrative. Sitcoms still exist, but I think we're in an era, particularly of television, that's like doing a lot with narratives very intentionally. But it's funny, we almost like watch it faster than ever. So I've found that a lot of people are really craving, whoa, I need to have a conversation about, you know, Breaking Bad or True Detectives or whatever it is. But yeah, it's about kind of creating that space, I think. And doing it with other people. I shouldn't watch Requiem for a Dream all alone. That haunted me for like 3 years until I talked to somebody about it. And I was like, oh, I understand now. Yeah, but maybe consuming less of our entertainment alone and treating it a bit less like entertainment and more like the powerful story that it is. Giving it a bit of respect, I guess. Mm-hmm. Not all films are meant to be that way, and not all stories are meant to be that way. You know, there's some films or stories that are just fun and we should just enjoy them for fun. But there's a lot of stuff out there that's saying something, but we consume it like it's just fun. So that's kind of a funny dynamic.
I find that as I grew older, I grew less tolerant of warfare, and warfare seems to just abound in Narnia and Tolkien. I mean, I used to watch the first film because I loved it so much. I watched the same one until the second one came, and it didn't bother me as much then, but I can't stand orcs anymore. Yeah. It's just, I guess I'm a mum.
Yeah.
But there's, oh, I love the Shire. I'd like some device to just skip the bits that are not necessarily necessary for the story to flow. Okay, we know that there's a war. We don't need to go on and on.
Yeah.
Who killed who and how. And I grew up in communist Romania, and for all the, I don't know, embarrassment of the communists cleansing what was on television, I guess they didn't exactly kill. They used to show the soap Dallas every Thursday evening it was on, but there was no nudity in it. They didn't up. I mean, we didn't miss anything, did we? So yeah, I don't know whether, because I'm all for, you know, engaging with the story and not just discarding things just because there's breasts and foul language. On the same, at the same time, you know, you can't have the kids in the room, so when do you watch it? Because our kids are still young and will be young for another 10 years for certain films.
Yeah.
So it would be nice to have just the software that, you know, between second such and such and such and such.
Sure. Just for practical reasons.
Yeah.
Sure. And especially thinking about the kids, if you want them to enjoy the Shire but not be traumatized by the orcs or something.
And even now, you know, they'll have to wait a while before
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure there's something like that that exists, although I'm not sure, not familiar.
And I wonder why. Is there a taste for, because I'm not sure. It seems like in the Harry Potter, I stopped watching them because I find it too hard. It's just so scary. The books are scary enough and I can cope with the books.
Yeah.
It's a bit gratuitous, I think.
Yeah, I mean, gratuitous violence, particularly violence, and probably sex. I mean, that's a reality in the world that we live in. So it's, you know, and that's why I find this kind of metric of, you know, a great story tells the truth, a bad story tells a lie, is a very helpful thing in the sense that, like, you know, if you're watching a scene that's like a very violent scene that treats human life as if it's, you know, many violent scenes do that, don't they? Where it's just like, you just fly through the bad guys and they're all just like dying left and right and there's no sort of attention to that. That was a life. That was a precious thing. Like that was, I would say like that's a small little lie that a lot of violent movies or not so much in books, simply because I think it's such a visual thing that films deal in. That they engage in very often. You know, Andy and I have just been rewatching the television show The Wire, which is a very violent television show about inner city Baltimore in the States. But the violence shows what violence is and what it does to a community. And so for mature watchers, it's like, it's not gratuitous, even though it's, there is much of it. You meet the mothers of the young boys who are killed on the street. You know, you have the sense that every life that is lost was real and valuable, as opposed to just the battle scenes where people are just flying around. Yeah. So I would say, yeah, a sort of gratuitous violence might be another word for violence that sort of tells a lie about what death is. Mm. Death is not a casual or easy thing for any of us and who have seen it or experienced it. And so, yeah, I see why it's done for special effects. But yeah, I can definitely
understand.
I'm probably
more sensitive to it, to be fair. Mm. Lost.
Yeah. And I think you're right that as we get older and we see enough of it in the real world, don't we, that we recognize the depth and the pain of it that is maybe different than when we were young. Paolo, you're back there raising your hand, I think, in the dark.
Yeah. I really appreciate what you said can help us as spectators. I don't want to go off track, but have you thought a little bit about things that might be also helpful to us when we become actors, engaging in, let's say we are actually actors in plays that will embody all of those characteristics, or even in games, we play roles in games.
Yes.
All of those things. So I might have missed it.
Well, no, it just came up at a lunch discussion earlier this term, and I was just chatting with Owen about it before we started that I meant to do a bit of research beforehand about like what. When we're actually sort of in helping participate in creating the narrative, because there's more complications in that. It's one thing to sort of witness something, and it's another thing to sort of do it. So my answer to Owen was that I don't really know yet, only that it's more complicated, isn't it? Acting, I would say, not as much simply because... No, because you have you have examples of like method actors that get into their role in such a way that they can get lost in it. So you have Joaquin Phoenix would be an example of that, or Heath Ledger famously who committed suicide. So yeah, that if you sort of, I think it's Tom Hanks who kind of despises method acting and says something to the effect of like, if you can't come home at the end of the day and be you, then there's something wrong. This is a job. You know, you need to kind of have that separation. But some people, try to dissolve those lines, don't they, in order to have a more effective... So it is, I would just say it's more complicated, but I don't know how yet. Like, I would love to do some more thinking about it or read some, if anybody has any, resources, I'd be interested in seeing if anyone's done some thinking about what kind of implications being kind of actors in that space. Because I think it's more problematic, I would say, as well. It's one thing to sort of watch something and internalize it and understand how it's happening in that world to these people, and another thing to place yourself in that world and have a limited number of choices that you're allowed to make. So in a video game context, you have your choices are sort of built into the game, and you have just symbols mean different things. You know, it's what it means to succeed in the context of a game means something different than what it might look like in real life. So yeah, I would just say super complicated. I have no idea, but definitely probably more. I would, even though I think I don't tend to say, oh, be very careful. I think in that area, I would say, you should probably be a little more careful. But I don't know.
There are a few good studies on gaming. I think there's one I briefly looked at.
I'd love to see that. Yeah, if you come across it.
Yeah, there was a chapter on ethics. Like Christian and religious.
Yeah, Andy would be a good person to talk to about that. He's done a bit more thinking about games than I have. Yeah.
You mentioned Mystery and Manners by O'Connor. And you mentioned a few films and things, but are there any other resources or actual fiction texts that you would point us to?
Yeah, there's a writer named John Gardner who has a book called On Moral Fiction. And that's really good. He has an idea that fiction should be something that affirms life. And he's very unusual in the kind of fiction world right now, in terms of saying like fiction should have a moral backbone to it. It should say something about the world. He's very kind of like from the, even though he's contemporary, he's a teacher now, he's kind of writing more from the time of like Charles Dickens, or the Russian classics who felt that like fiction had something to sort of teach us and help us understand about the world. Even if it was something, again, quite dark. Like I'm reading Crime and Punishment right now, which is very classic but very hard. So I'd recommend that. And then Mystery Manners is really good. Again, she's a sassy lady, so she's really fun to just like read. Because she had a lot of, you know, she was in 1950s America, very much claiming to be a Christian, and got a lot of sort of backlash for how unusual and disturbing her stories were. And so she was constantly kind of defending it and telling people it was their problem in a way that is just very engaging. But the rest are just kind of my thoughts, something that I've been thinking about for a while. Yeah, sure.
Actually, this is arguing for engagement, which is very switched on.
Yep.
But how, I think quite a lot of people, regardless if it's like very violent or if it's like this romantic rom-com, they're desensitized by exposure to these things, and therefore, like, sometimes people like laugh, not because they're nervous or uncomfortable, but because suddenly this has become entertainment and it doesn't have any truth or reality behind it, which I find like, wah! So I guess, how do we, either as individuals, or who have friends who maybe are desensitized, how do we engage with that? How do we recognize that? And how do we engage with that? And how do we, without being judgmental or, you know, because some people, if I just want to watch something, I just want to, you know, like, yeah, want to analyze it, you know, like get off my back type thing. So I don't know, just like how do we engage with the aspect that, well, a lot of people, they become desensitized to things and don't see the horrificness behind something anymore.
Yeah.
So they've watched 7 hours of this, you know, straight and it doesn't mean anything.
Sure. Yeah, there's a complex interplay between the sort of stories that we absorb and then come to think is normal. So, yeah, how I probably was with Disney movies when I was a kid or something like that. It wouldn't have surprised me for you to say, you know, your life is about you becoming a wonderful individual person who's a, you know, a star or something like that. Like, so my beliefs kind of followed that line of thinking. And also our beliefs, like we carry, like what we believe here in the world, how we spend our days, how we spend our weekends, our conversations, we carry them also into film world or story world. So I'm thinking about the experience of watching the film Wolf of Wall Street, which is about, I mean, it was so hard to watch, but it's just this basically stockbroker or guy working in the financial world in New York and becoming extremely successful, but doing it through illegal means. And the film made it look very sexy. And I remember there was this one part where he did a lot of drugs, and he was high on Quaaludes, and he was trying to like leave the hotel and get into his car. And he was like, I mean, it like broke my heart. I mean, just to see a human. He couldn't stand up and he couldn't speak, and he was like stumbling on his way to the car, and I was just sitting there just feeling like just broken for this man who was so lost, and the whole theater around me was just laughing. Like, it was just physical comedy, and I was just like, how do I relate to this? Like, how do I even relate to my culture sitting around me right now? Because I was just so sad, and his whole life made me so sad. So yeah, I think that if I had been sitting with any of those people laughing, I would wonder like, yeah, is this a part of your life too? And is this a way that you deal with it by just saying it's funny? And like, I think, or yeah, have you bought into this idea that this very rich, like glamorous life that this man has is the sort of American dream now? And so I think, yeah, I would just be curious. I mean, that's such a cop-out answer, but just to like know those people and know the ways in which like stories impact their lives, and their lives impact the way that they interact with stories, and speak to that, like to that level, and yeah, hope that there would be some vulnerability there on the part of, you know, anyone who's ever been falling down drunk or overloaded in their system with drugs. Like, that's not just a funny experience in the moment. It might be after, as a way of like dealing with it, but I think anyone that's had that experience, like there's a sadness or a fear, even if it's just a glimpse of it. And I guess I would just like hope that we would have that in common somehow, or yeah, But I think in the context of relationship and just, you know, you have good relationships with these people that maybe in a more vulnerable moment they might be able to admit, like, this is actually not funny or this is actually not okay. And just hang out until then, I guess. I think there was a hand up further back, and then Megan and Emma.
Yeah, well, I was gonna say that's like in line with the story we just read. So detached, and like I think to some extent the answer is like finding like reality that forces them into unease, and that doesn't mean like beating them over the head with it, but like waiting for that reality to come and break in through that.
Yeah. And that's a grace that is extended to all of us. I deeply believe that. That none of us are completely lost. Megan?
Yeah, just going off of that, I think... So, because, you know, now trigger warnings have become such a prominent idea in culture.
And do you want to explain that a little bit, just in case nobody's familiar with that? Because that is a relatively recent phenomenon.
Yeah, so trigger warnings... have become something that people use, particularly I've noticed in like, you know, the college setting. Like we use it in the theater a lot for different shows that may contain acts of violence or like sensitive topics that people may have had negative experiences with in their lives, such as like sexual assault or abuse or suicide. And now, you know, I feel like we've reached a point that there are people who have used those things as hyperbole and have, you know, talked about how much they're triggered by something. That there's kind of this retaliation against it now in our current culture, and it's become a meme. So, like, people are like, oh, well, oh, no, you're triggering me. Oh, no, I'm triggered. Oh, no, you, like, you put that plate on a certain spot of the table. I'm triggered. So I'm trying to figure out, like, how to approach that because, you know, there are these large sensitive topics that, you know, we are so numb to in our daily media consumption. But it's like it's kind of... Yeah, there's such a retaliation against that now that I'm not really sure how to navigate it.
Yeah, it's an interesting cultural phenomenon, isn't it? That there's on one side an increasing sensitivity or an increasing sense of sensitivity and an increasing need, whether for legal reasons or what have you, to warn people that something might come that might make you feel sensitive, both emotionally, and then that's also happening in our food culture, and you know, that so there's kind of like a movement there toward like kind of hyper individualized experience and care, but then a movement against it as well, right? So you're noticing people accusing people with those sensitivities of them not being valid, or maybe a less emotional version of this would be like the gluten-free movement has made a lot of people feel like being gluten-free is like a made-up diet or something like that, and then a person who has celiac disease goes to a cafe and the waiter doesn't take them seriously and forgets to give them the gluten-free thing, and or, you know, doesn't take it seriously enough to like actually make sure that it's allergen-free, and then the person gets sick or something like that. So it's like as one rises, the maybe feeling of being overwhelmed by that or insensitive to it rises as well. Yeah, I don't know what I think about that. It feels like the better thing would be somewhere in the middle, which is that we're fairly robust as human beings, generally, as a population, so we don't need to be afraid, to share, you know, in a university class, you know, to discuss something that would be hard or difficult for us to think about. We're fairly robust, but also PTSD is a real thing, and like trauma is a real thing and triggers are real. They affect a minority of, you know, the population, but they're still real. So I always have mixed feelings about it in the sense that I kind of like that, you know, there's been an increased awareness that, you might have someone in your class who's had a really traumatic experience, and that, you know, I try before I show a film on a Wednesday night to just say, you know, if you're sensitive to blah, 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 close your eyes or like, let me know, or you know, just as a courtesy. So I like it as a courtesy. And I think it's not fair to sort of judge other sensitivities, while also I recognize that the kind of hyper-individualized culture can easily make us cynical, because perhaps in an effort to sort of self-care, we can classify ourselves as very sensitive people when perhaps we're more robust than we think, or can participate more communally than we think. But yeah, I'm not really sure. It's an interesting thing, though, like two extremes, whereas I feel like maybe a bit more understanding in the middle would be easier. I should let y'all go. If you want to keep talking, I will sit right here. Thank you for your attention and for staying awake.